This is Hassan Akram, your host for Autonomous Vehicle Safety and Security Podcast, brought to you by Matrix. Welcome back to another new episode of Matrix Tech Talk. Today, I'm super excited to have Tal Kreisler, all the way from Tel Aviv, the CEO and co-founder of No Traffic. Tal, welcome to Matrix Tech Talk.
Yes, Hassan, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So Tal is a passionate entrepreneur. He's a co-founder of No Traffic. He is professionally a lawyer and an accountant. And Tal, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself, your background, your passion, and what inspired you to found No Traffic?
Personally, I, the age of 15, I was establishing my first business. And since then, I was involved in several ventures. At some point, went to university. I studied business law and accounting, which right after I wanted to feel how does a grown-up a person job feels like. So I started to work for a consulting firm. I dealt with several various financial topics and projects, mainly from like the project finance and corporate finance side. And after almost 2 years that I spent with the company, which by the way was an amazing time and amazing people, I got to an understanding that I need to go to the other side. So instead of telling people what to do and to ask other people what I should do. So I took a jump back to the entrepreneurial end, met or regrouped with two good friends of mine who are coming from the deep technological side. The first one, his name is Uriel, he's our CTO. So he was in a senior position in a cybersecurity startup that was just acquired by IBM for $680 million. So he had a time and he wanted to establish his own venture. And my other co-founder, his name is O. So he's also coming from the tech side. And he was also working for a long time for a company dealing with the computer vision and deep learning algorithms. And he also had a kind of a maturity and he wanted to open his own company. So he regrouped. And Uriel, in his back of his mind, had an idea that he was keeping from 2011, which back then he was standing in an intersection in the middle of the night and he didn't got any green light. So he just tried to drive back and forth and nothing happened and he just drove him crazy. So he's this type of people that have to understand how things are working or why they are not working. And if they are not working, how can you fix them? So he had this idea in his mind and he started to roll this idea. We started to look at this domain. We thought that's kind of an amazing domain because it's haven't changed for so many years. So we took a deep dive before we raised any funds or before we recruited any people to the company. We initially wanted to do kind of a validation check for ourselves. At the end of the day, we invested a lot of money and time and we wanted to make sure that we are on the right path to do something which is really big. So we took a leap of faith. I don't know how, but we got accepted to kind of a program and sort of an accelerator in the US. So we spent a few months there, starting to learn the domain. We met with like tens of cities and Department of Transportations and domain leaders and anyone that had any kind of information or influence or know something about traffic management. And it just struck us even more when we understood that what we believe exists is far away from the reality. So what we've discovered in a way that like the first traffic lights are invented more or less about 100 years back. And in every intersection, there is a traffic light controller, which is simply let's call it the brain of the intersection, right? And this traffic light controller, his job is to change the lights on and off and provide a green light to the various approaches in a safe manner. Now, the first traffic light controllers were electromechanical, so they had like a dial that was turning. An average cycle was about 120 seconds. And in order to tell the traffic light controller how to allocate this green light time between the different phases, cities were doing manual traffic counts, creating timing plan, which later on they implemented into the controller, and this is how it works. Now, fast forward to today, and nothing really changed too much. So most of the traffic light controllers are not electromechanical anymore. Most of them are digital, but from the methodology side, the functionality-wise, nothing changed. They still have this fixed cycle. Cities are still using manual traffic counts to create timing plans, which later on being implemented into the controller. And this is how the system works for the next 3 to 5 years until it's being retimed again. In fact, according to the US Department of Transportation, more than 99% of the traffic lights in the US are not reacting in real time to what really happened on the road. And when we started to explore, we saw that that's true also for Europe, to Southeast Asia, and probably to the entire world. Now, I think that together with some other trends that we've seen, at the end of the day, I think that timing is probably the most important factor. You know, it's kind of this problem. Many people ask me, how come no one solved it before? And there are several good reasons for this. One, I think that the maturity of the technology was not there. There are a lot of technological challenges. And one example is that one of our board members, his name is Professor Matan Gartner, he invented the first system in the world, the first algorithm that optimized traffic lights intersection in real time. Back then, about 50 years back, he came, he approached cities and he said, I can solve your traffic problems. And they told him, you know, by all means, let's do it. And he said, all you need to do is to put one mainframe computer in every intersection, and that's it, we got it. And obviously they told him it's not as easy as it sounds. He was coming from the academia. Today we could get the same amount of compute using this thing. So the maturity of technology is one side. The other side was the, let's call it the human factor. We see more and more and more, in a way, younger people, or younger in the spirit, in a way, that's more open for technology, that work for cities and say, you know, how come we can order stuff from Amazon and get it in like 2 hours, whereas on our daily operation, we're still using spreadsheets from the 70s or methodologies like counting traffic with our hands. It doesn't make sense. There must be some better solution. So the human factor is another one. And the third angle is the entire development from the mobility side, mainly the automotive, which is super fascinating. But I think that the entire focus, if we take like, if we go 4 or 5 years back, the entire industry thought that if we'll upgrade the vehicles, we're going to solve all the problems in the world. So there will be no traffic jams, no accidents, everything will be amazing. And when the time flies, also all the car manufacturers started to understand, I think the entire industry understand it, it's not just the vehicle. The vehicle is an important component, that's for sure. But the entire ecosystem have to be connected to make it efficient. So the analogy is that if we go back to 1908, when the first T-Mobile vehicle was presented by Henry Ford, it was not just the vehicle. Now you need roads, and you need gas stations, and you need garages, and you need a lot of things around it to support the vehicle. Because without them, if you have a vehicle with no roads, you cannot do anything with the vehicle. If you have no gas station, you cannot do anything with the vehicle. If you cannot fix your vehicle, it's worthless. So it's becoming more like very similar to what we've seen back then. We're in the doorstep of a new era where the vehicle is transforming to be something digital, and the entire surrounding have to be digital as well in order to support it and to utilize all those amazing capabilities that all of us want to enjoy from. So the third factor in terms of timing was that the OEMs, the car manufacturers, were starting to push cities to upgrade their infrastructure to support those vehicles. And cities were clueless because there is no regulation, no standardization, and no one tell them what to do. So just imagine that you sit now in an office in a city and you have very influential companies like, you know, the car manufacturers, specifically in Germany, like those are big companies that have a lot of reputation. And now they're telling you, do something with the infrastructure. And you're like, you know, what do you mean? What should I do? How should I do? There's a lot of question of who's going to pay for it? Who's going to maintain it? Who's going to be liable for this? So it became like a very chaotic topic. And what we saw that because there is no regulation or standardization, cities are hesitate to do stuff. Bear in mind that this is a public money. And if now a city go and deploy something and from some reason they find out in a year after that this something is worthless, they spend public money. That's not good. So they prefer to try to do stuff or to not to do stuff or to do some minor things. So they were very hesitant in terms of like, what should we do? Now you can add to all of this stuff, this whole debate between the communication between vehicle and vehicle and vehicle infrastructure, like the two standards, the CV2X and the V2X, the DSRC. This is just add another layer of complexity because for them, it's even much easier to say now, you know, until you're going to solve it, we're just going to wait. Because we cannot bet on one standard if tomorrow the standard is going to be completely different. So this entire ecosystem from our end, or this entire, all this pressure that came from a lot of angles, showed us there is amazing opportunity to build here a company that will solve all this complexity. And this is why and how we established the company back then. We brought all of our friends on board and that came to work in the beginning, because they understood that there is amazing domain, that it's not being disrupted or not being changed at all by technology. And there's a huge potential to build here something really big. So that's kind of how we started.
Amazing. There are so many stimulating points you've mentioned. So what you're trying to do, to put it in a summarized way for my audience, is you want to optimize traffic real time in the infrastructure level, and you will also have connectivity of the vehicle in the infrastructure level that will make it even more optimized. It is amazing. So I would want to circle back to the question, why haven't people done before? You've already answered that. The question is the ROI of it is enormous. However, what I'm missing is your monetization model, because I'll be saving time. So time is money. Everybody will be saving time. But how will you monetize? How do you plan to monetize such a system in an urban environment?
Another thing that people usually don't really know about traffic management is that this domain is already exists. Cities paying millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on maintaining their existing infrastructure, in intersection in specific, which means that every few years, the cities have to go through a manual traffic count and retime their traffic light. That costs money. In every intersection, there is basic detection system. It has to be renewed every few years. On top of this, today it's a hardware-driven market. So we have various narrow solutions that solve very specific problems that usually also do not communicate between. So I spoke about like the traffic counts and the traditional detection stuff. On top, you have solution for optimizing or prioritizing emergency vehicles. Those solutions already exist, but this is another system that you put, another hardware piece that you put. Then you have a solution to prioritize public transportation. Now you add some more hardware on top. You have a solution for communication. It can be cellular communication. It can be direct communication, another layer. And now we have like a bunch of hardware stuff. It usually do not even communicate with the other components. And just inventing more and more and more hardware solution it's not that it's not just solve the problem, it's actually make it more complex. So one of our first customers sitting in Southern California, when they contacted us, they said that they were trying to solve traffic or traffic problem. They have budget to improve traffic management across the city. And they couldn't find one solution that solve everything. So they make like a coalition with about 8 or 9 vendors that each vendor provided his solution. Now, in a way, they purchased the shiniest hardware pieces in the market. Now, what happened after is that every vendor promised them that once they will purchase the hardware, he will make sure that it will be integrated with other components. Now, I guess you're guessing now how it actually looks in the reality. What happened after is that they purchased all this shiny hardware. And in the second half after they purchased it, they had something like this. So every vendor was pointing on the other vendor and tell the city that it's the job of the other vendor to send data to him or to communicate with him, and then he will work on the integration. Now, until today, we are about 4 years after, this city still have hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment lying in the cabinet, not connected to anything.
Totally get it.
So the money is there. It's not about just the money, by the way. Transforming the infrastructure to digital also open up various other sources of revenue channels that not exist today. In fact, I think it was Amnon Shashua from Mobileye. He was estimated connected vehicle services by $160 billion market. So obviously it's a lot of stuff, but when things become connected, it's opened up a lot of opportunities. And one of the trends that we actually see today, and we have quite a few conversation about, is that cities are actually trying to utilize and to monetize their infrastructure in a much better way. A lot of the funding for infrastructure is coming from fuel tax, and the fuel tax is going down because, first of all, the fuel price, and second, the vehicle is becoming more efficient. So in fact, you have more vehicles, about 100 million vehicles, new vehicles that are hitting the road every year, but their efficiency is increasing, so you have less money to support those vehicles. And therefore, somehow you need to finance this gap. Now, what a lot of cities are thinking is, you know, what do we have? What kind of asset we have that we can monetize? And there are a lot of interesting ways to monetize infrastructure. I can tell you that we've been contacted by cities that wanted to prioritize commercial fleets for pay prioritization. I mean, why should those commercial fleets stay in a red traffic light in like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when anyway there is no one there? Why shouldn't they just drive straight to the highway, save time, fuel, maintenance costs, etc., and pay a few cents to get it? So there are a lot of additional ways that this infrastructure can be monetized, by the way, for the benefit and the sake of all of us.
Fascinating. So since we're in the autonomous vehicle safety and security podcast, I want to touch a bit on the safety aspect of it. Especially, it's a perfect segue with your last example. So the commercial vehicle, even if it is red, I have the privilege. I bought the privilege from the city. So I would just drive past the red light because I'm privileged. How would the safety be taken care of in your system? Do you have a safety concept for such an infrastructure algorithm?
This one is important to talk about, as you said before. I think that, first of all, I want to talk about the biggest argument or discussion, or when we're talking about vehicles and cities, each and every one of them is looking at different values. And those values are kind of two parallel lines that never meet. So it's kind of fascinating, I think, to understand what the OEM or what the car manufacturer think and what cities think. Because if you go backwards, the entire V2X thing came from the car manufacturer that says, we want to increase safety. And if we will deploy something on the roadside in potential risky place, that can increase safety. So they came to cities and they said, you're going to deploy those devices, you're going to pay for them, and you're going to maintain them. What they didn't understand, that if you look at things from the city side, things look much different. Because if you'll ask cities what is one of their main problems or challenges, that's congestion. In a way, they want to invest in road capacity or in throughput, because that's also something that we appreciate. There's also some psychological aspects for this. If now a certain city is building a new road, we all enjoy it. We know how to evaluate it in a day after. If now a certain city will tell you that they deployed some thingies around the road, and instead of two accidents last year, there was one accident, meaning the accident dropped in 50%, how are you going to look at this? Are you going to evaluate this, or are you going to look at this like, you know, okay, that's nice to have? So most cities that we met with, and by the way, you can simply look at their financial statements, how much money is allocated to safety and how much money is allocated to road capacity. And then you'll see that cities are, they investing a lot in road capacity. They do not investing a lot in safety. And therefore, when the OEMs back then came to the cities and says, you're going to deploy those things across the road maintain them, that was not very appealing request from the city side. And that's why it was stuck. And until today, we have the same debate. Until today, the OEMs coming to cities and asking them to deploy this stuff, and they surprised every time, why cities not keen to deploy this thing? Because it's increased safety. So I think that we need to understand a different interest. And once we understand this fundamental different interest that we have to those two different domains in a way, that until today, they haven't spoke. There was no communication whatsoever. Whoever managed the traffic, which is the traffic lights, that, by the way, it's a simply automation of police officers of back in the days, they have no relationship whatsoever with whoever used the road, which is the pedestrians and the vehicles. Now, what we are trying to do is to communicate and to bridge this gap, to manage the traffic flow based on the actual demand of the road users. Road users are everyone. It's not just the vehicles, it's also the pedestrians. Because if you're pushing the push button, the traffic light controller doesn't know if there's like 100 pedestrians there or even or only one. He doesn't know if you finish crossing, if there's an elderly person that takes him some more time. And he doesn't even know if it's safe for you to cross with a vehicle when it gives you the red light, the green light, because maybe someone else is going to now run the red light from the other side and he's going to hit you. So in a way, traffic lights are an authority that's supposed to tell you it's safe for you to go. Here's your green light. Effectively, it doesn't happen because they have no idea if it's really safe for you. And this is why about 40% of accidents happen in intersections. So it became the most unsafe place on the road. A lot of things that we can speak about in related to increasing safety. First and foremost is how do you allow those two domains to speak? How do you take in consideration a vehicle that's apparently about to run the red light and you are asking from the vehicle in the other side to wait because it's not safe for him yet to go? This is more fundamental stuff. And there is complete correlation between wrong traffic light timing to accident. If the cycles are too short, people are becoming anxious, they're driving in the red light. So there's a lot of things related to this. Most pedestrians think that the push buttons are not actually working. And from the city side, they're paying a lot of money for them. We're talking about thousands of dollars that are being paid for those push buttons and even more. A lot of cities have maintenance people that go in once a month and push all those push buttons in every intersection just to make sure that they're working. Now, just imagine the other side. We are coming to the intersection. We say, you know, it's crap. It doesn't connect it to anything. So providing the right service to everyone in this in the vicinity of the intersection, allowing everyone to get and to enjoy much safer environment, this is kind of the basic. On top of this, we can talk about some other verticals or some other layers, how we can increase safety, how we can provide more data to vehicles that are approaching to the intersection. I think that one of the main reasons for traffic accidents, specifically when we're talking about red light runners, I don't believe that most people are criminals. That's why I don't believe also in red light cameras. I do believe that we don't have enough data to get to the right decision. Meaning, when you're driving toward an intersection and you have no idea what's the distance, no idea when the traffic light is going to change, and you don't really know what's the accurate speed. But even if you knew all of this, it took you a fair amount of time to sit and calculate whether you can make it or not. So just think about it that in the morning when you choose your shirt, you have more time to take this kind of decision than the time that you have in every day on the road that you need to decide whether you're going to make it or not. And sometimes we take the wrong decision and therefore we have accidents.
Amazing. So you mentioned interesting points. So 40% of the accidents, fatalities you mentioned are happening at the junction. Now, there are two ways we can imagine your solution in practice. One is you are communicating with a vehicle that is driven by a human. Scenario one. Scenario two, a vehicle that is driven by a software, a fully autonomous vehicle. There should be a third or even fourth scenario where there is a mix. So when it comes to human, so that will be definitely the first generation, because we are yet to go to the full autonomous mode. We'll take some time, especially in the urban environment scenario, till we get there. So there's this factor that always comes into play: human acceptance. Because we're so used to the infrastructure that we have, how much of a change do you think people will have to go through? The users, the traffic users, the drivers will have to go through in order to accept it. Because in my money, that would be one of the factors that would define the success of deployment of such technology.
I will divide my answer into two parts. The first part is I think that the adoption is fairly fast. When the first cellular phones were presented, the projected penetration rate was something like 1%, because they said, who needs a cell phone, right? So the only people that really need cellular phones are the truck drivers. In the year after, they changed the projection to 3% penetration, and the rest is history. So I think that we as human beings, once we are being exposed to something that improves our life dramatically, it's going super fast. Now, having said that, there are some examples of places that were trying to improve, specifically in the traffic industry, were trying to improve and do stuff. And specifically in traffic, because a lot of time we used to get this kind of an order of, or a sequence of the traffic light, it might change a little bit, because if now you're serving the approach that really have demand and not necessarily the one that should be per the sequence, it might change a little bit. But yet again, I think it's really minor changes in compared to the advantage that we get from those new technologies that already exist, already up and running and improve dramatically the life of hundreds of thousands of people. So with some of our deployments in the US, we did some case studies showing the impact. And the numbers are simply phenomenal. And I think that's because when you're starting to work in a very traditional domain, the marginal change is huge. It's not just, you know, taking the iPhone 11 and update it to the iPhone 12. It's taking this old dial phone and replace it with the iPhone 11. And that's a huge change with a lot of values to each and every one of us. That's reflected by the cleaner air that all of us are going to breathe, because there are less emissions, less of accidents, spending less time on the road, or getting home faster, get better decision. Where should we drive from? I'm a big fan of navigation apps. But so many times I got to a place when I was stuck in like congestion or traffic jam, and those navigation apps haven't told me anything. And I'm not talking about some remote location in the middle of nowhere. I'm talking about the biggest cities around the world. So in a way, having this whole environment communicating is something that all of us as human beings, consumers, citizens, will get benefit from.
So I would move a little bit toward your entrepreneurial journey. From your LinkedIn page, I've seen you have raised a seed capital of 6.7 million so far. So tell me about your fundraising journey. Are you making revenue already? Where is your prototype? Is it already in deployment?
First of all, a couple of words about the system. What we've developed is the first solution in the world that automates and manages traffic light grids in real time, with the goal of solving major traffic management challenges, but also to unlock various of those advanced mobility solutions that we are spoke about just now. In other words, we're simply laying the digital infrastructure for various mobility services. That's our goal as a company. Now, in order to do it, we need, first of all, to transform the network to be connected and to have enough data to provide all of those services. Today, most traffic lights in the world are not connected to anything. And the data that exists is very, very, very limited. Most of it coming from those inductive loops or very traditional sensors that providing very limited data. So the first step is to deploy, we need to deploy our platform. We have a few very simple hardware components that we need to put. We have sensors that collect data. They have various components inside, so they can collect data 24/7 in all types of weather about every road users that are approaching to the intersection. We have amazing artificial intelligent algorithms that are running in the sensor itself and allow it to collect and process all this data locally. And the other component that we have is another kind of an adapter box or an edge computing communication device that we are connecting to the existing traffic light controller. And this box is taking the data locally from the sensors and also communicate it through the cloud with the other intersections. The entire deployment of this proprietary hardware platform takes less than 2 hours. So in 2 hours, we transform every intersection in the middle of nowhere without any asking anything from the city side. It's becoming connected and intelligent. Now, once the platform is there, we are providing various services to the local government and to other stakeholders in the surrounding. First of all, in terms of services to the public sector, we are providing optimization, priorities for various types of vehicles. It can be emergency vehicles, transit signals, a transit signal priority, pedestrians priority, origin destination data, advanced analytics, like a lot of stuff that we can provide them on top. For the private sector, we can now unlock this amazing data for various needs, like make this data accessible for car manufacturers so they can get the timing of the traffic lights in advance before you arrive to the intersection. Navigation app. I mean, there's like a lot of use cases that we are, some of them in discussion and some of them are already working with. So we are already deployed with several amazing cities and DOTs across the US. We spent the last 2 years to stabilize our system, to design and build the initial concept. Bear in mind that we are talking about critical infrastructure, so there is no room to mess up. So you have the things have to work properly. And that's kind of was our focus, to make sure that our system is delivering good results, get amazing feedback, a great reference base from the leading and most great DOTs in the US. And so that's kind of the state that we are at, increasing our deployments mainly in the US and looking to be in about 40 cities in the end of 2021.
Amazing. So I want to ask you one more sort of technical question. You're working with US cities, so it looks like your focus is the United States. How about, you know, do you see there are challenges for localization? Because traffic in the United States and traffic in Europe are fundamentally different. Especially if you take Germany, cars move much, much slower in the United States compared to German roads, the traffic and everything, and also the mindset of people is, there's a big difference when I'm driving in New York or in San Francisco versus I'm driving in Munich. What's your thoughts on that? Are you also thinking of localization of the algorithm, or will your algorithm work universally? Tell us a little bit about that.
If you take a citizen from New York, Munich, Rome, and Tokyo, all of them have one thing in common. If you ask them whether they ever wait at 2 o'clock in the morning in a traffic light and were frustrated, all of them will probably say yes. So the system fundamentally work almost the same all over. Like the methodology, the technique is very similar. There are some changes in the behavior, that's completely true. But from the infrastructure side, it doesn't really matter, because today the infrastructure is totally ignoring this kind of behavior. And what we are doing is exactly bridging this gap of adapting or connecting between the infrastructure to whoever used the roads. And the behavior might be different in Germany, in the US, in Japan, whatever. Point is that the system can adapt. There's a lot of benefits that derive from this, but at the end of the day, I mean, the domain, and that's what was strikes me the most. I was traveling back then when it was something common, all around the world, and I saw exactly the same phenomena, the same frustrations, and more or less the same systems. So it's something that's common to all of us.
Let's start with a person, you know, Tal Chrysler. What I noted, and I was fascinated that you told us that you started your first company, first business at the age of 15. And today you are running a multi-million-dollar startup. And I want to talk about that entire journey. How was it at the age 15? And what was your business at the age of 15?
Back then, a good friend of mine had his father kind of have a license to exterminate like cockroaches and this kind of stuff. And we just wanted to play, and we wanted to see if this thing play. So we just printed a lot of like flyers, and we put it all over, you know, in the entire region. We just wrote that we have a business, and if someone in a to get rid of kind of like bugs or whatever, just you know, give us a call. By the way, later, like a few years after, there was a, I think it was Lean Startups that was published and was talking about MVPs and stuff, and the fact that you should do like a kind of a Facebook page and just write what you're doing, and if people click on it, then you have a business. So we did it like 20 years back, more or less, but with no internet. So we just printed the flyers and we started to get calls. People were starting to call us, and they said, yeah, okay, when can you come? And we're like, okay, that's amazing. So we can actually do here real business. So we started to build this thing up. We got to kind of a very nice operation. We were obviously still in school, so we couldn't do it full time. But we started to generate real money. And for a young kid, when you started to see, like, I remember that in the first time I went to the bank with like kind of a bunch of bills and want to deposit it, which is something that you don't do in this age. Usually you just get money from your parents. And back then I was actually depositing bills. That was an amazing feeling. So that was then. And since then, there was like various startups that I was had a privilege and chance to be involved with. I think that's kind of a great privilege that all of us have, that if we see something, that we see the potential and something that we like to do, that we can simply go out and do it and also get paid for it. That's amazing.
That is amazing indeed.
So, and therefore, like, I encourage anyone that have something that disturb him, if you want to solve it and he can actually make money from it, it's like the best combination in the world. So this is, that's how it started back then. As I mentioned, I really wanted to try grown-up work because, you know, I really wanted to go with like suits and stuff and to feel how it is. It was nice, but I didn't have this adrenaline that I have now. Because when you build your own thing, it's only up to you, for good and bad. If you fail, it's you. If you succeed, it's you, or you and your partners in that case. But there's no one to blame. So in a way, it's very easy. Because it's like, you know, you can say that the market is not allowing something. You can say that, you know, I don't know, whatever. But at the end of the day, it's very simple. It's either you make it or not.
Either you make it or not. So you've made it a long way. When was your company No Traffic founded?
That was in late 2017.
It's fairly young. Yeah. Did you have any other round other than the seed round you mentioned in your Facebook page, 6.7 million? Or was it the first round?
Actually, the seed was like 2.7. And just right after, we had some various other investors that wanted to join. So we just extended the round like a few months after and got some more funds. And then we got another grant from the something that's called Israel Innovation Authority. So in Israel, we have this kind of a really amazing initiative and authorities that support tech companies and providing grants to a tech company that, after going through a major due diligence process, they believe that those companies can have a real major impact on the world that we are living in. I think that's amazing. So we got like a few grants and we got this kind of a round that extended. All in all, it was about $8 million. So it was still good. And we have some revenues on top. So it went really well. And we're probably going to raise our next round soon. So that's something that we are starting to work on. Sorry, we have amazing investors that are supporting us, which I'm really proud to have, assisting us in many things. And I think that bringing the right, like build the right team is a super important thing, not just the employees and the partners, which obviously it's super important, but also everyone around you, from the investors to any advisors that you have, to people that believe in this core mission that you are after, that actually feel part of. And during this journey, as you mentioned, it's not too long yet. We had the privilege to bring amazing people on board. Some of them, for example, one of them is Victor Mendez, who was the previous deputy secretary of the U.S. Department of Transportation. Victor actually initiated a program that's called Everyday Counts, a program in the federal government that its entire purpose is to bring innovation to the federal government. So there was like really good match. We had various conversations and then we decided to join forces. We have amazing people from the academy that's supporting and working with us closely. And I think that one thing that's important to say about all of them is that they're not just there for their pretty faces. All of them coming to conferences, working with us, assisting us. In fact, one of our angel investors, which is one of the busiest angel investors in the Israeli market, just texted me a few months back and he said, I feel that I'm working for you full time. I was like, yeah, that's how it should be. And that's a compliment, by the way, when he told me this kind of thing. So I was, it was really amazing to get it. So I think that that's kind of the most important thing.
Fascinating. So in the end, there is this question I asked to all my guests is, you touched this point in the beginning. You talked about that, the fact that we're about to move into a new era of vehicles. So autonomous vehicle, electrification of vehicle, and connected vehicle is going to change the game for all of us. And it's not going to be a new way of commuting from point A to point B. It's going to be a new way of living, new way of socializing, new way of doing things, probably also buying things. So we'll come with certainly advantages and disadvantages. So in your opinion, what would be the most positive and what could be the most negative thing in this technological change that's going to happen in the near future?
I tend to look at the bright side. That's usually my focus. I think it will be amazing. I can't wait. Seriously, I really just want to take a small, kind of like just to see how it will look like 20 years from now. I think that technology has developed much faster than what we are expecting or thinking. So yeah, there are some delays with autonomous vehicles. We did expect to see them in 2020. It will take a few more years. That's fine. But it will happen sooner or later. The question is not if, it's when. And I do believe that in the next 10 years or so, we're going to see here on the roads, or as you mentioned before, it's not just the vehicle, this entire, the way that we are consuming services will be changed. I think that's for the benefit of all of us. We'll spend less money, less time, obviously. We will change our whole concept of how we move things, or in a way, how people and goods move from one place to another. And obviously that will impact cost as well. So I do expect that things will be much cheaper and affordable. There's all the time this fear from technology that when things are being automated, some of the jobs, working places are being shut down. And I think that that's not necessarily right. Because if you think about what happened in just in like, let's say 3 years, this whole gig economy actually opened up various positions, make it much more easier for all of us to work. And I wish when I was a student, if Wolt or those food delivery services or Uber exist, it was much more convenient for me. I could go to work whenever I want, can decide how much money I need to get and how many hours I need to work for it. Everything is becoming much more custom. So there are alternative working place that's coming with technology that actually make it much more easier for us as people to go to work. It's not necessarily, if you want to work, it's not necessarily 8 to 5. Now you can decide if you want to do it 8 to 5 or 9 to 6, or if you just want to do it in the end of the day when you finish school and you want to get some dollars. So yeah, so as I said, I see the positive side of things, and I think we're going to a really good place, and can't wait to see it.
Amazing. Tal Chrysler from No Traffic, all the way from Tel Aviv. Tal, it was amazing having you in our podcast. So thank you so much for watching our podcast. If you have questions, comment, please feel free to write in the comment section. And please, if you've liked the discussion, smash the like button and share this video with your peers. We'd love to see you in the next episode. Thank you for watching.